Hello, I'm Andy Burnham, and you're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts. This week, a look at video compression and how it works. Leaky feeder radio on the London Underground. A PC the size of a credit card. Millimeter wave lasers open up the microwave bands. The role of Daventry through the years. A look at the technology behind McLaren and Honda's Formula One racing cars. And CD Secure. Lots more, as well as your letters, on Sparks every week from Radio Facts. 3910 6205 and 12255.
Everybody always picking on me. I did not put you here to suffer. No, I did not put you here to whine. I put you here to love one another. Yes, and the kid at play.
Story about securing data on compact disc. Nimbus Information Systems and C. Diller Associates has developed a way of encrypting information on CD-ROM, which is claimed will prevent unauthorized access to the data. The new process, known as CD Secure, is implemented at the mastering stage and is unlocked by a special program installed on the end user's PC. According to Nimbus, there is no significant loss in real-time performance. Run speed is held to within 2%. No changes are made to the original application software, and end users do not require any additional hardware. Encryption can be applied to the whole disk or just to a single file, and can also be specific to text, image, audio, or video information. The system currently offers three levels of security, with the highest level of protection producing the greatest penalty on runtime performance. Built into the encryption process are embargo and expiry functions, which ensure that only the latest information is accessible to the user. These functions also create the opportunity for try and buy marketing of disks, which will be accessible for a limited time, after which the purchaser will need to buy the unlock program in order to continue using the disk. Another possibility, stated Nimbus, is the ability to incorporate different software on a single disk. Given the large data storage capability of CD-ROM, several programs could be stored on a single disk, with purchasers buying various unlock programs to access each application. Without the CD Secure Unlock program, lost, borrowed, or stolen disks are unreadable. Also, the data cannot be copied or downloaded without the key. That's by Carl Snape in ProSound News Europe.
And from Electronics Times, Leaky Cables to Keep Tube Trains in Touch by Peter Firth. As part of a £120 million telecoms investment, London Underground is planning to make it possible to listen to the radio and receive paging messages while travelling on the tube. Mark Plato, communications service engineer, said the plan is to install a low-loss leaky feeder cable around the entire network. Radio signals would be fed into the leaky feeder and leak out from any point on the cable network to be picked up by paging receivers or radios. London Underground plans to spend £100 million on the cable and amplifying equipment. The money will also cover the building of a central transmission station. This will house the radio network management equipment and provide the paging operators and radio broadcasters with a single site to transmit from. Plato claimed all the paging operators were interested. Until now, they've resisted installing base stations at underground stations because of the expense of covering them all. It would also have been pointless because messages could not have been received on trains. Plato claimed the leaky feeder would get round both problems. The network will also be available to the Metropolitan Police and the fire and ambulance services, as well as customers who already have their own frequency spectrum. London Underground says it will apply for extra spectrum for those who do not have their own. The plans are due to be finalised this year, and the service should be available in 2 years. London Underground is also spending another £20 million on fibre optics along its tracks, primarily for its own internal communications. The company is still looking for partners to offer a public telephone service. So, £100 million for leaky feeders. Well, judging how strapped for cash they are, I imagine they're going to be selling these things to people. So I wonder if they're going to be asking the radio stations for rent to play their station underground so they can be heard by extra listeners. I wonder how much they'll charge, and I wonder if any stations will take them up on it. Well, it remains to be seen. Let's have a letter now from New Zealand, of all places, David Nairn, who's in Christchurch. He picked us up on 12255. And he's listening with a Sony ICF68000W with a 30-metre long wire aerial. The weather fine but cool down where he is. And a letter from Manuel Carrillo, who's in Madrid in Spain. He listens on a Kenwood R600 with a long wire indoor aerial. Hello to Manuel Carrillo. And a letter now from London, Mr. P.J. Cowley, who says, I live most of the year on the Czech-Hungarian border and listen to the quarter of an hour programmes from Antwerp and the same on Hilversum, giving the latest gossip about shortwave English broadcast changes out there, as BBC World Service is not too reliable on shortwave at the times I'm home. Maybe I can get you there, as I get LBC on medium wave. Well, I should think you ought to be able to. but it is very mountainous. That's maybe why. Well, that shouldn't affect our reception. My best and loudest programmes are 4 till 6, when I get Radio Australia Pacific service for the Polynesian and Cook Islands on 17565 and 17715. Then, when I go to bed, Pacific Sunrise, a local Australian programme, 5 till 7am, out there, 10 till 12 in Czechoslovakia, with lots of bright music and local traffic road reports. That must be really useful to you in Czechoslovakia. Anyway, otherwise, my only 100% station seems to be Emirates Radio on the 13-metre band, but they only consist of, quote, fairy stories. I can easily get South Korea, North Korea, Vietnam English services, also Radio Havana and Christ Science Service. Well, good luck with picking us up when you're back in Czechoslovakia. Interesting place to live, Mr. P.J. Cowley.
The Philips DC 777 car radio is a must for all serious shortwave listeners who spend time in the car. The Philips DC 777 packs a sophisticated shortwave tuner, AM/FM tuner and cassette player and powerful stereo amplifier into a standard size car radio unit. AM, FM and shortwave coverage from 3170 to 21910 continuous. The stereo cassette deck is also auto-reverse. Check out the review in the World Radio and TV Handbook, and it received 4 stars in the Radio Netherlands receiver shopping list. This top-of-the-range Philips car combination is available to Radiofax listeners at the special price of £249. Contact the Radiofax sales office by telephone in the UK on 0483 275 997, or write for the brochure at Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, GU67BG in England.
The sound of Kiss 94 FM, your radical radio, with yours truly, Jazzy B, pumping the beats across London town. And here's another smoking jammy, Say a Little Prayer.
The moment I wake up, before I put on my makeup, I say a little prayer for you. And while combing my hair now, and wondering I love you.
Millimetric lasers open up communications. One of the natural obstacles to opening up the millimeter wave bands is the difficulty of generating signals. Smaller wavelengths mean smaller active devices, which in turn can handle less and less power. Researchers have generally responded to this problem by building arrays of devices integrated into what purports to be a single millimeter wave transistor. Alternatively, the devices can be paralleled, either at the circuit level or even as parts of a composite active antenna. All components operate at the same frequency and add together to boost the final transmitted power. An alternative to this paralleling technique is currently being explored by a team under Assistant Professor Richard Compton in the Electrical Engineering Department at Cornell University. It makes use of a technique that has been borrowed from the world of lasers and is known as mode locking. Instead of having all the oscillators running at the same frequency, they are run at slightly different frequencies. If the frequencies are equally spaced, then at one instant they will all add together to give a large signal, but for all other times tend to cancel one another out. The Cornell team has demonstrated a five-element array operating at the very modest frequency of 10 GHz, which produces a pulsed signal much more powerful than the continuous wave emitted by a conventional parallel array. A CW source with five elements emits five times the power of a single element, whereas a mode-locked array generates a peak power 25 times larger. In general, mode locking increases peak power by the square of the number of circuit elements. While Compton's source is still relatively low powered, in the range of several watts, it is suitable for communications and is claimed to be better than the milliwatt devices currently available. Several car manufacturers are working on collision avoidance systems, and a good millimeter wave source could provide a significant advance in this area that would lead to a large demand for such devices. Crowding of communications channels also will provide impetus for the development of devices that use frequencies in the millimeter range. In addition to new television and satellite telephone transmitters, cellular telephones and paging devices, millimeter systems could form the basis for powerful military jamming equipment or small airborne radars that could provide enhanced detail of terrain and more precise information about location. The chief hurdle to practical applications, according to Compton, is the cost of fabricating, packaging, and testing devices. At present, he uses the National Nanofabrication Facility at Cornell to make the microscopic gallium arsenide devices, but points out that an automated industrial facility would bring costs down to a reasonable range. The millimeter bands contain some frequencies, such as 35 and 94 gigahertz, that propagate well through the atmospheric window to satellites. At 60 gigahertz, however, the atmosphere blocks transmission, which makes this frequency ideal for military satellite-to-satellite communication that is undetectable by listeners on the ground. The mode-locked millimeter source has an unexpected but useful property. The direction of the pulsed signal automatically shifts around at a very rapid rate. This feature frequently must be added to a communication device so that it will transmit omnidirectionally. In mode-locking, however, beam scanning arises as a natural consequence of the system. The next step in his research, Compton says, is to build larger arrays that operate at higher frequencies. He selected 10 GHz for the 5-element array because 10 GHz transistors are relatively inexpensive and easily available. That was in Electronics and Wireless World.
British firm claims credit card PC in Electronics World News by Roger Woolnough. A small British company claims it's taken the European lead in developing a product based on the single-chip PC introduced last year by Chips and Technologies. DSP Design, which specialises in highly integrated PCs for industrial and OEM applications, used the 160-pin chip to create a full-function IBM-compatible personal computer system on a printed circuit board about the size of a credit card. Called the Gold Card AT GCAT, the product gives better performance than the average desktop AT. The company plans to sell the credit card-sized PC in Europe for £475 in single quantities. Several functions have been combined with the PC chip on the GCAT. These include a CGA-compatible display up to 640 by 200 pixels for LCDs or double-scan CRTs, and a built-in negative voltage generator for liquid crystal displays. Also included are a socket for memory cards, a speaker and calendar clock, an RS232 serial port, and expansion capacity via a connector with a PC bus pinout. Onboard memory, 128K or 256K of static RAM. That's the credit card-sized personal computer available now.
The closure of Daventry after 70 years is covered in the BBC's own staff magazine, Aerial. Claire Barrett reports. In 1925, when John Reith was Director General of the BBC, £2,670 could buy you 50 acres of land and almost 67 years of BBC broadcasting in the form of Daventry Transmitting Station. But the station has finally passed its sell-by date and closed. Now, a lone mast to be used for communications purposes will remain to remind the local community, which has provided the transmitter with many workers over the decades, of the Borough Hills site's stake in the history of British broadcasting. In the 1920s, the station's new long-wave transmitter, known as 5XX, made Daventry the first of the BBC transmitting stations to broadcast a national programme and to cover a sizeable proportion of the UK population. And shortly after, 5GB, the BBC's first high-power medium-wave transmitter, which was designed and built by BBC staff in a matter of months, came into operation and the regional service began. Both services were relocated to Droitwich in the 1930s. Christmas 1932 was marked by another Daventry first, the broadcast of King George V's Round the Empire festive message. It heralded the introduction of the Empire Service, forerunner of World Service. With the expansion of overseas broadcasting to include foreign language services at the request of the British government later that decade, Daventry was to play a crucial role in sending morale-boosting signals to Europe and Asia to counteract the wartime radio propaganda of Hitler and Mussolini. The Second World War drained Daventry of its workers, and so female technical staff, known as technical assistants, brackets female, were recruited for the first time. They survived just until the male staff returned from the war, not to be seen for another 30 years. In the 1950s, third programme, Radio 3 transmissions from Daventry began. In the 1960s, the Far East was in the station's broadcasting reach, made possible by a first phase of re-engineering work. And by the late 80s, a second phase resulted in six new 300-kilowatt automatic transmitters coming into operation. Broadcasting aside, the Daventry site was used for early radar tests, as a navigational beacon, for communication purposes by the Air Ministry, and as the site of the Air Meteorological Service. Daventry's last transmitting duties of World Service programmes on shortwave are transferred to the Wooferton station, which has spare capacity following a reduction in its Voice of America transmission obligations. As a result of the closure, 40 posts have been lost, but without any enforced redundancies or enforced moves. But the BBC and the Borough Hill site are not ending their successful relationship. Daventry will remain the base for the maintenance of domestic services radio and television transmitting stations within a 50 to 60 mile radius of the site. And other specialist maintenance and stores and supply departments will also be retained, along with the radio tape reclamation service. To Director of Engineering Bill Denay, who began his career at Daventry 37 years ago, the station is part of the culture of wireless. In some ways, Daventry was the old Empire service itself, he recalls. You would tune your wireless not to the Empire service, but to a spot on the dial with the word Daventry. As the first of the big four shortwave transmitters, Rampisham, Skelton and Wooferton followed later, it was part of broadcasting history in the real sense. Claire Barrett there, writing in Aerial magazine.
You're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts. Every Monday and Tuesday, it's our weekly look at science, technology and media news. And apologies for any late arrivals, any missed programmes, etc., as there's been a postal strike which has been causing us some problems. The Independent Television Commission has chosen a new company called Teletext UK to run the Oracle Teletext service. Teletext UK, a venture between Philips, Media Ventures International and Associated Newspapers, put in a bid of £8.2 million a year for the 10-year licence. Philips, a pioneer of Teletext, is currently working on technology to speed up the service. Let's have a letter now from Howard Stanion, who's in Market Harborough in Leicestershire. A small market town situated in a river valley, the River Welland, approximately 15 miles from the city of Leicester. I've visited it myself. I'm 30 years of age and work as a TV and video repairer, writes Howard. I'm a very keen DXer and would appreciate a reply. Well, you're going to get one of them. He says, good programming. I will tune in again. Several friends already listen. Well, thanks for that report and letter. That's Howard Stanion in Market Harborough. And a letter from Sweden. Torbjörn Tyler, who's in Lund in Sweden. Yes, 3910 he's listening to. Your programmes are very good indeed, he says. He's listening on a low HF 225 with 110-metre long wire aerial. And he's 18 years old. Thanks for that report, Torbjörn. And you're very welcome to write to us at Sparks. Any comments on the programme are appreciated, as long as any information, news you might have. Also, any interesting things you've picked up around the bands, write in and I'll say hello to you on air and read out a bit of your letter. Or if you'd like a reply, please also send 50 pence, three international reply coupons, or one US dollar. The address, Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. A joint venture in virtual reality is being set up in London. That's Europe's largest. It's a venture to develop a virtual world for designing lighting in buildings, involving Thorn EMI, VR Firm Division, and the London Parallel Application Centre. Based at their headquarters in Queen Mary and Westfield College, the two-year project will enable lighting designers to enter highly realistic virtual buildings, where they will be able to investigate the effects of changing the location and intensity of light sources. That from Electronics Weekly. And the European community will study terrestrial digital television by Simon Lowe in Electronics World News. The European Commission is completing plans for a collaborative research project into terrestrial transmission of digital television. The aim of the unannounced project is to leverage Europe's previous work on digital audio broadcasting by applying new modulation techniques to TV transmission, so more channels can be squeezed into the existing UHF spectrum. Because digital transmission has a high carrier-to-noise ratio, the hope is to transmit digital TV signals at low power and have them coexist with current analog TV channels inside the UHF spectrum. Ultimately, the research could be applied to high-definition television. The proposed project, known as Digital Terrestrial Television Broadcasting, would probe the use of orthogonal frequency division multiplexing and compression techniques to increase the number of channels in UHF. If the project is launched, it will become the missing piece in the European community's digital TV research portfolio. European community programmes are now underway in other key areas, such as picture coding and digital TV transmission by either satellite or broadband networks. Although the announcement has not yet been made, one EEC official in Brussels confirmed that the Commission has agreed in principle to back such a project. In a recent meeting, EC representatives said the Commission would initially provide only part of the funding sought by proponents of the project. Industry representatives are now exploring additional sources of funds. When officially launched, the project will be part of the EC's Research and Development in Advanced Communications Technologies in Europe, known as RACE. The DTTB effort was initially proposed to the European community last year by a group of European broadcasters, telecommunications operators and consumer electronics manufacturers. The proposal will build on work conducted by the UK's Independent Television Commission. Since 1990, the ITC has been doing research into applying ODFDM, used in digital audio broadcasting to transmit digital television transmissions. Field trials of the system are set for this year. In addition to OFDM, the ITC system employs motion-compensated discrete cosine transformation coding to compress digital TV signals to exist in the redundant space of the analog broadcast system in the UHF spectrum. We've got an article about that in a few moments on Sparks. Redundancy in the analog signals exists to compensate for analog TV signals' sensitivity to interference. A major hurdle facing the digital TV broadcast scheme is to avoid interfering with analog TV signals. Early studies have shown this could be overcome by using low power levels in digital TV transmissions, and the OFDM, orthogonal frequency division multiplexing, which is spectrum efficient and has a high immunity to interference. The work is believed to be the most advanced in the world on terrestrial TV transmission, said Nick Lodge, R&D coordinator for the ITC. Proponents of the DTTB project plan to develop a complete prototype system, including new ICs that would compress the digital television signals from 34 megabits per second to 12 megabits per second for transmission with the existing UHF spectrum. The ICs would also modulate the signal for transmission and reconvert data into a TV image at the receiver. That report from Electronics World News.
John Griffiths looks at the technical side of Formula One car racing. The plethora of red and white cars emerging from air freighters in Sao Paulo made up a technological package with which McLaren hopes to wrest back the advantage it has yielded to Mansell and Williams. There was seemingly enough electronic and telemetry, remote data transmission gear, to start a space program. Developed by TAG International Systems, a McLaren subsidiary, it is used to monitor information produced by more than 800 sensors in each car. Crouched over their display terminals in the racetrack's pits, McLaren engineers can observe and analyse everything about the car's behaviour while it is hurtling round the track. In this latest twist of technology, the pits team can alter, by remote control, fuel mixture, the engine speed at which the semi-automatic gearbox changes gear, or dozens of other parameters, without the driver so much as lifting his foot off the throttle. The two McLaren drivers have six cars at their disposal, rather than the usual three or four. Three of them, designated MP4-7As, are the new model on which McLaren has staked its credibility and that of its partner Honda. In secret development for a year, the cars employ drive-by-wire technology, which will take Senna and Berger partly into the unknown in terms of driving techniques, as well as, McLaren hopes, back into the victory lane. There is, for example, no mechanical link between the driver and accelerator, or between the press-button gearbox controls and the gearbox itself. The driver's physical commands are relayed electronically. The engine and gearbox decide between them whether the driver has changed down too early while travelling too fast. In the recent past, that would have meant an over-revved and probably exploded engine. Now the system can ignore the gear change for a few microseconds while engine speed is adjusted to suit. It is on this state-of-the-art technology that the McLaren-Honda team is pinning its hopes. Having dominated motor racing for most of the past decade, the Anglo-Japanese team lost its edge to Williams, a situation which Ron Dennis, founder, part owner and managing director of McLaren International, does not relish. For Honda, which has spent much of the past decade cultivating an image as Japan's BMW, and thus has a strongly commercial stake in McLaren's success, the current scenario is no less galling. Unreasonable as it is to expect any team to carry on winning the world championship ad infinitum, Honda's relegation comes at a time when Grand Prix motor racing worldwide has gained unprecedented popularity. The £1 billion a year industry attracts at least 100 million television viewers worldwide for each Grand Prix event. Dennis, 45, who now controls a small high-tech empire employing nearly 400 in an industrial estate in Woking, Surrey, has already become a legend in motor racing for the clinical precision with which he has approached winning. His perfectionism extends even to insisting that the 30-strong pit team has all new clothing for every Grand Prix. Combined with his intuitive engineering and managerial skills, he went straight from school in Woking into engineering, it has earned him the grudging respect of McLaren's rivals. It is all the more surprising, therefore, that McLaren should, for the moment, be on the defensive. Dennis admits that McLaren was lulled into a false sense of security by Senna winning the opening four rounds of the championship last year. He concluded that McLaren's cars were sufficiently superior to its rivals for the company to get on with developing the far more advanced MP47A for 1992. But by mid-season, the Williams team had overcome its initial unreliability and was outpacing the McLarens. Recalls Dennis ruefully, Grand Prix is like a roundabout. The music starts, everyone gets on, it increases speed through the season and only slows down when the season ends. And it's very difficult to do anything while you're on the horse. The tools keep sliding off. All the team can do is hold on tight. Sometimes the less well-organized teams don't even know if they're sitting on the horse backwards. The moment you lose your balance, you're history. Dennis has no intention of becoming history. Indeed, the group he founded is in the process of metamorphosing into a multifaceted business in which Grand Prix racing will play only a part, though a key one. Within the next few months, McLaren Cars will launch its first road-going car, an exclusive £500,000 machine appropriately named F1 and incorporating much of the technology of the Grand Prix cars. Much of that technology will have been developed by TAG Electronic Systems, which is turning over more than £15 million annually and employs about 100 people. There is also a marketing services company and McLaren International itself, the Grand Prix Enterprise. The usually reticent Dennis observes, the group is at a crossroads. It is emerging as a corporate entity. As the drivers climb into their McLarens, though, putting their skills and technology to the test, it will not be the balance sheet that matters, but taking the checkered flag. John Griffiths, writing in the Financial Times.
This week on Sparks, video compression, how it works, leaky feeder radio on the London Underground, a PC the size of a credit card, millimeter wave lasers open up the microwave bands, the role of Daventry through the years, a look at the technology behind McLaren Honda's Formula One racing cars, and a profile of CD Secure, all in this week's Sparks from Radiofax. And now Barry Fox writing in Studio Sound about the release and subsequent updating of the classic cartoon Fantasia. The Disney Studios restored Fantasia for limited cinema screens in 1990 to mark the film's 50th anniversary. Then Disney released it on home video for a sales window of around 3 months. Disney now withdraws the film forever in preparation for a new version to be released in around 5 years' time. Some sequences of the 1940 original will be replaced by completely new ones. Walt Disney had originally planned to use Mickey Mouse in a series of animated shorts, for which Leopold Stokowski, conductor of the Philadelphia Orchestra, would record the music. In the late 1930s, the project grew into a full-length feature film of classical music recordings, made by Stokowski to match Disney's animated sequences. Stokowski had been working since 1932 with the Bell Telephone Labs in New Jersey on hi-fi sound recording and transmission, first in mono and then in stereo. Bell Labs had found that disc recordings could not give a good dynamic range, so tried using optical film soundtracks instead. Bell Labs even used a film system to give playback recitals of recorded music in concert halls. Walt Disney teamed up with RCA to build Fantasound, which gave not just stereo, but a surround sound. Fantasia was the first feature film with stereo or surround. The Disney and RCA engineers used 8 separate optical 35mm film recorders to make an 8-track recording of Stokowski's orchestra. In Disney's Hollywood studios, Disney and RCA engineers mixed down the 8 optical music tracks into 3 optical tracks, carrying sound for the left, center, and right of the cinema screen. Cleverly, a 4th track was used to overcome a problem inherent in optical sound recording, since it was first used in the 1920s. If overloaded, optical tracks clip. If undermodulated, they suffer badly from ground noise hiss. In those days, the late 30s, there was no Dolby system or safe companion. Fantasound recorded everything at 100% modulation. Control tones on the 4th optical track, called the TOGAD or tone-operated gain adjusting device, electrically adjusted the gain of the amplifiers in the cinema. At the same time, notches were cut in the side of the film to switch relays, which routed some of the sound to loudspeakers round the cinema and even behind the audience. In 1940, no ordinary cinema could cope with these technical requirements. To show Fantasia, the cinema had to install 2 projectors, running together in sync, one for the reels of 35mm film carrying the sound with TOGAD and notching, the other for a 35mm film print with the pictures. There were 60 loudspeakers round the cinema to surround the audience with Fantasound. The Disney Studios organised Fantasia as a roadshow, with the equipment transported in 35 enormous packing cases across North America. That was in 1940. America's involvement in the Second World War curtailed these plans, and Disney released a single 35mm print with mono sound for projection in cinemas around the world. In 1955, when Hollywood started releasing widescreen CinemaScope films with magnetic stereo soundtracks, the Disney Studios discovered that the original Fantasound soundtracks, which were on nitrate stock, were disintegrating. There was only one Fantasound playback system remaining at RCA's sound studio in Hollywood, miles away from the Disney Studios in Burbank. The Fantasound equipment was old and awkward to move, so Disney's engineers took the decaying film to RCA and played it on the Fantasound unit. They then fed the sound down telephone lines to Disney Studios, where it was recorded on 3-track magnetic film. Even though Disney used Class A telephone lines, this crosstown transfer limited the frequency range of the recording to under 9 kHz. narrowed the previously wide dynamic range, and introduced distortion. Also, the engineers had to pan the TOGAD volume control and notched surround sound effects into three channels. The decisions they took were effectively frozen into the re-recording made at the other end of the telephone lines. So much of the original subtlety of the effects planned by Disney and Stokowski were lost. This is the sound which cinema audiences have heard ever since. To be strictly accurate, Disney tried in 1982 to get round the problem by re-releasing Fantasia with a new soundtrack, recorded by a new orchestra under Irwin Kostel, using 3M digital equipment. The project was an artistic and commercial disaster, even though the Disney studios hyped it with the magic label Digital. All the original Fantasound equipment has now disappeared. The nitrate film has long since disintegrated. Stuck with only the three-track telephone line transfer to work with, Terry Porter searched the studio archives for blueprints of the original recording equipment. He also found Stokowski's original scores, complete with the conductor's notes. Together, the notes and annotated score explained how Fantasound panned the sound round the cinema, according to Stokowski's wishes. In all, Porter worked for 2 years on recreating the original track in modern Dolby Stereo, with music sounds coming from where Stokowski originally placed them. He spent 3 months filtering and equalizing to try and undo as much of the damage done by the telephone line transfer as possible. Porter found that the telephone transfer had skimmed off all frequencies above 8.6 kHz, at least a kilohertz narrower than a good optical track. As well as trimming the treble frequencies, the telephone lines had introduced hum at the mains frequency of 60 Hz, with harmonics at 120 and 240 Hz upwards. Additionally, Porter erased over 3,000 clicks and pops, which blemished the sound. Terry Porter has nothing but admiration for the original Fantasound technology. The method of 100% modulation was a wonderful noise reduction system if you haven't got Dolby, he says. The big breakthrough was finding Stokowski's notes. That let us remix the three-track sound into six-track Dolby for a 70mm release print which was screened at the Cinerama cinema theatre in Hollywood and at Paris and Nice as part of the 50th anniversary Fantasia celebrations. The six-track 70mm release used a modified Dolby surround system to spread three channels behind the screen and three more round the cinema. This comes as close as possible to the original 1940 roadshow effect. All Porter's work was done in the analog domain with Dolby SR, but transferring to Dolby Stereo presented special problems. Porter found there were substantial phase shifts between the three tracks of the telephone transfer. Back in 1955, the telephone company had very likely provided Disney with three separate lines which travelled by routes of quite different length across the city. Until corrected, these phase shifts played havoc with Dolby surround matrix encoding. They caused even more problems with the mono track, which was needed for linear video release. In the end, Porter went back to the original mono film version of Fantasia, which for the post-war years was the only available cinema release. He used this track for linear mono instead of a mixdown from the new stereo version. That's a fascinating report by Barry Fox about how they rejuvenated the Fantasia release for recent showing, which I got the chance to see while it was on release, and very good it was too.
Video data reduction by John Watkinson in International Broadcast Engineer. The mathematical techniques behind video data reduction are certainly not new. Fax machines have been doing it for years. Very little in this world is totally new. Why then should it be now that data reduction is becoming such a talking point? The answer lies in the economics of LSI chips. The logic power and complexity of chips is increasing rapidly, but the cost is not. Thus, the cost of implementing a calculation of given complexity actually falls from 1 year to the next. In the case of computationally intensive processes, such as data reduction, implementation was prohibitively expensive until relatively recently. A similar situation was observed with Reed-Solomon error correction. Although devised in the 1950s, it was not possible to implement it economically until a couple of decades later. Paradoxically, the development of Reed-Solomon coding chips was one of the foundations of high-density digital recording. Early digital videotape recording experiments were forced to use crude forms of data reduction because the data rate was beyond the technology of the day. Modern DVTR technology is such that data reduction is not strictly necessary for normal definition production recorders. Comparison of the tape consumption of D3 with quadruplex video illustrates the progress made to date, but more interestingly reveals the slope of the trend. The recording density of D3 is not as high as that achieved in RDAT, yet neither format is anywhere near the fundamental physical limits. Future DVTRs will have even higher recording density and cost even less to run. In this light, the digital Betacam starts to look like a knee-jerk reaction to the success of Panasonic's D3 format. Terrestrial broadcast channels are well established, and there is an enormous installed base of conventional analog receivers. Although the transmission of the traditional analog television picture is grossly inefficient, the upheaval involved in replacing it with something using less bandwidth is not worth the expense, because at the end of the day, the viewer will see no tangible difference. Work is currently underway to create what is called extended definition television. In extended definition, the goal is to produce a transmission which requires the same bandwidth as a conventional picture and which can be displayed on a conventional set. A special receiver will be able to extract more information from the signal than can a conventional set and will use it to enhance the resolution of the picture. That at least is the theory. The reality is complicated by the aspect ratio problem. Apparently, we like a wider aspect ratio television picture than the current 4:3. I say apparently because I don't personally care for 16:9 in small screen sizes. It belongs in the cinema where it excels. The problem is that to make a compatible 16:9 extended definition set, the picture when seen on a normal set will be a letterbox with black bars above and below. On the extended definition receiver, only 75% of the lines will be used to scan the picture area, and the vertical resolution will fall by a corresponding amount. Unfortunately, the vertical resolution of PAL is already inferior to the horizontal resolution because it was designed using a KEL factor based on non-interlaced pictures, and the KEL factor is worse with interlace. The result is that the owner of the conventional set is worse off, and the quality of the picture on the special set is open to question. One solution is to add some form of detail enhancing information in the blanking areas at the top and bottom of the screen. Clearly, this can only use the voltage levels below blanking, or it would be visible on a 4:3 set. This drastically cuts the information capacity. For the purpose of this article, the key factor is that the bandwidth of the signal has to be the same as conventional television and has to be compatible with it. If data reduction is unnecessary to transmit the conventional signal, it is not needed to transmit the enhanced signal. The places where data reduction is relevant are primarily new areas where there is not a large base of traditional equipment to displace. High-definition television, multimedia, and desktop video are all prime candidates, with the consumer digital VCR a possibility. High-definition television is a subject which seems yearly to move further away from technical reality as it pays the price of being a political football. Politics will ensure that there will never be a worldwide HD TV standard, and it is naive to think otherwise. The relative ease with which standards converters can be built with modern LSI means that having several standards may not be all that much of a problem anyway. One thing that is absolutely certain is that high definition is not going anywhere without data reduction. The analog signal from a high definition camera uses about 30 MHz of bandwidth, which is prohibitively expensive to broadcast directly. Data reduction allows HDTV to be broadcast in a more reasonable bandwidth, and only then does it become economic. As data reduction is a digital process, and digital transmission is more efficient than analog, it makes sense to design an HDTV system which uses both data reduction and digital transmission. If this causes you to ask the question, where does this leave Mac? The answer is it leaves Mac behind. Mac was a great improvement over PAL because it made good use of the blanking periods which PAL wastes, and because chroma and luminance were kept perfectly separated. Mac was drowned at birth by a political decision to allow satellite broadcasting in PAL as well. The off-air BSB signal was excellent when viewed in component form, but most viewers connected the Mac box to their TV set via the antenna cable, and so watched in remodulated UHF PAL and saw no improvement, because BSB failed to educate their public to use the SCART lead to view in component RGB. All that is now history. And, in the light of data reduction technology, Mac is now obsolete and should not be considered for high-definition television. Future satellite and terrestrial high-definition TV services should be digital. Bandwidth will always be at a premium, and, as the cost of the chips continues to fall, digital transmission is the only logical method of delivering a tangibly better picture than PAL at a similar cost. While it is obvious that HDTV should be digital, it is not obvious what display technology will be used, as the CRT cannot deliver. A CRT which will not fall through the floor is not large enough to resolve high definition because of the resampling by the shadow mask. If you doubt that, inquire why the HDTV focus operator uses a monochrome monitor.
Oh, dreams and crying all night. Oh, but that was so long ago.
The similarity between a TV set and a computer is quite obvious, as both have a large CRT display. The main difference between the two is that traditionally the computer does not have sufficient storage capacity to display moving video. With data reduction, that is no longer true. The computer industry has now sold a personal computer to almost everybody who needs one, and has a product which advances in operating speed and reduces in cost regularly. In order to explore new markets, the computer industry is looking to video. Personal computers with TV tuners are now available in the USA, so it is possible to watch TV on the monitor. With data reduction, it will be possible to make a PC which acts like a video recorder using Winchester disk drive for storage. If one sets out to purchase a computer, why buy an ordinary model if it can be a TV set and a video recorder as well? The idea of a machine which could be programmed by user-friendly icons like a Macintosh sounds attractive. Modern consumer VCRs are a complete joke, with their sophisticated electronics protected by an impenetrable wall of user-hostile buttons. These are quite unnecessary if the one-box, one-function mentality is abandoned. The Winchester disk drive has an on-off switch and an access light, yet it can perform the same function as a VCR and do so with better picture quality. Moving away from consumer devices, one approach which will have a tremendous impact on television production is desktop video. Using computers, disk drives and data reduction, it is possible to build more than just a video recorder. An entire edit suite can be made. Unlike tape recorders, this edit suite needs no pre-rolls and rewinds end-to-end in 100 milliseconds. Early desktop machines produced video quality which was obviously below broadcast standard, but they were intended to generate edit decision lists offline. With modern data reduction algorithms, these machines will be able to produce better quality and could become the online editors, initially for industrial use, later for broadcast use. Perhaps the VTR will be relegated to archiving and playout. Distribution of video programs to transmitters and from one studio to another involves the PTTs of the relevant country. They are only interested in the Shannon capacity of their lines and charge by the product of bandwidth, time, and dynamic range. Digital landlines are attractive because they offer negligible quality loss compared with analog. The landlines from Marco Polo House to the Chilworth uplink were digital from the beginning of BSB. With data reduction, the cost of such lines can be reduced. Much of this is good news and quite exciting, but how does it work? Stated simply, conventional video contains a lot of redundancy, which adds bulk without adding information. Data reduction is designed to retain the information whilst getting rid of the bulk. It's a bit like buying a bottle of concentrate for a soda stream and adding your own water and carbon dioxide instead of buying cans of cola. The concentrate determines what the drink tastes like. Data reduction is classified into two main areas. For still picture work, it can only be performed in two dimensions on an array of pixels. The redundancy is in areas of similar brightness and hue, where many pixels are virtually the same. In the case of moving video, advantage can be taken of redundancy between successive frames, where, for example, the camera is fixed and the only changes are due to objects moving. The algorithms for video data reduction need to be standardized so that data-reduced files can be transferred from one place to another. The standardization is being performed by the ISO. The still picture standard is named after the Joint Photographic Expert Group Working Party, which developed it, and is known as JPEG, whereas the algorithms for moving video are the responsibility of the Moving Picture Expert Group, MPEG. The details of data reduction are only really suitable for discussion between consenting mathematicians, but it is intended here to give at least a feel for what happens. In any case, it is probably more important to know what the characteristics of data reduction are rather than how it works. To take a simple example, imagine it was necessary to transmit audio tones. To send a sine wave at 5 kHz would require 5 kHz bandwidth for as long as the tone was maintained. According to information theory, however, whenever a signal is totally predictable, it carries no information. If this could be taken literally, it would be possible to transmit quite a lot of programs using a bandwidth of 1 Hz. All cycles of our sine wave look the same, and the signal is heavily redundant. All that need be sent is the frequency, the amplitude, and the duration. Real sounds obviously have a complex spectrum, but making a spectral analysis allows the spectrum to be sent. The waveform can be synthesized later. In audio, it is not necessary to send the entire spectrum. Loud tones mask adjacent frequencies. If the human masking characteristics are known, the system only sends spectral entries which are audible. Such an approach relies on transforming the time domain audio signal into the frequency domain. In the time domain, the waveform fluctuates at high speed. In the frequency domain, the spectrum changes relatively slowly, and less data are needed to describe it. The earliest video data reduction application was the fax machine. The fax has the advantage that it normally works in binary. White is a 1 and black is a 0, or vice versa. Around 70% of the average fax is white paper, and it is pointless sending streams of identical bits when the reader scans a blank line between words. What the fax machine does is to send a code containing the number of identical bits in a row rather than the bits themselves. This requires less data. Another interesting fundamental, which the fax machine demonstrates, is that reduced data are more sensitive to errors. When a fax machine is on a bad line, the output is so much garbage because the incorrect reception of a bit count causes loss of horizontal position. In general, signals which have been subject to data reduction are more susceptible to errors because the expansion process expands the errors. Error concealment is less successful because it relies on redundancy, and there is, by definition, less redundancy in the data. More powerful error correction is necessary in data-reduced systems, and the additional error correction words use up some of the saving. Clearly, not all of the saving is used, or the exercise would be futile. Some insights into video data reduction techniques by John Watkinson in International Broadcast Engineer.
Thank you.
Spox is almost a year old now, and to celebrate that fact, here's another competition for you to enter. We've got four copies of The New Scientist poster, A History of Computing, which is quite a big thing. It's in a cartoon style, and it lists the history of computing in pictures all the way from Egyptian times up until the present day. Four copies of that. Now, the question is, on what date last year was the first date that Spox was heard on Radio Fax? The first date Spox was heard last year to win a copy of The New Scientist History of Computing poster. The address for all correspondents is Spox, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. And if you'd like a reply, then please send 50 pence, three international reply coupons, or one US dollar. The address, Spox, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. Or if you just want to send what you think of the programme, some reports of your own, some listening things you've heard around the bands recently, then please do so. Or to enter the competition, then you don't need to send any money, just send your letter and I'll read it out on air and say hello to you. In the Financial Times now, secret dilemma behind the descent of man. A.C. Grayling hails the definitive work on Charles Darwin's life, thought and times. Descended from the apes? Asked the wife of a canon of Worcester Cathedral. My dear, we will hope it is not true. If it is, let us pray it may not become generally known. With this sentiment, Charles Darwin himself long agreed. For more than 20 years after his epochal voyage on the Beagle, he kept secret his theory of evolution by natural selection. Fear of anyone discovering that he held such a view made him physically ill. The reasons are set out by Adrian Desmond and James Moore in their new biography of Darwin, a lavishly informative, compellingly readable account, which is without question destined to serve from now on as the definitive study of Darwin's life, thought and times. Without an account of the times, it is impossible to understand Darwin's reticence and debilitating psychosomatic illness, for it is in the struggle between religious orthodoxy and emerging science, and in particular the importance of this struggle for the political and social upheavals of the 1830s and 40s, that the secret of Darwin's dilemma lies. Desmond and Moore vividly depict the upheavals of the period and their effect on Darwin's thought. They never lose sight of the larger picture, while skillfully conducting us through the rich texture of Darwin's private life, which Darwin himself strove to keep as insulated as possible from the tumult of contemporary events. The result is like an epic. It reads like a thriller that yet makes accessible a wealth of historical and scientific detail about one of the chief intellectual revolutions of modern times. Charles Darwin was heir to a solid, non-conforming, comfortable bourgeois destiny of Darwin's and Wedgwood's. He had two famous grandfathers, Erasmus Darwin, physician, science writer and poet, and Hosiah Wedgwood, pottery manufacturer extraordinary. After Cambridge, Darwin might have fulfilled his father's hopes and become a clergyman, but an early passion for natural history led to the lucky accident of his joining the Beagle as gentleman scientist and captain's dining companion on its Admiralty survey around the South America and the Pacific. It was from the vast collection of biological, geological, and paleontological data accumulated by Darwin on his voyage that his theoretical studies grew. It also provided research material for many fellow scientists, including Robert Owen in his work on dinosaurs. Darwin's achievement as observer and collector was outstanding, and when he returned to England in 1836, aged only 27, he was already famous because of the many crates of specimens and letters of observation he had dispatched home. The material Darwin amassed contained the seeds of scientific revolution. Religious orthodoxy held that all species of living things had been simultaneously created in their present form at a single historical moment. the opposing idea that life evolved over large tracts of time from more primitive forms had been argued by thinkers as various as Darwin's own grandfather Erasmus and the Frenchman Jean-Baptiste Lamarck. The Orthodox were bitterly opposed to evolutionism because it threatened their belief in a universal hierarchy of nature and a society ordained by God. If nature and culture are self-evolving, and if the ultimate explanation of the evolutionary process is material rather than spiritual, they argued, the stability of the social order is threatened. Indeed, the radical press in the 1830s and 40s invoked evolutionary ideas in support of their demands for reform. It was not only churchmen and conservatives who saw in the accompanying political agitation a proof that evolutionary ideas are dangerous. Many in the scientific establishment agreed. And their most powerful argument against evolutionism was that no one had been able to propose a plausible mechanism by which evolution could take place. It was precisely such a mechanism that Darwin's theory offered. But he was afraid, to the point of disabling illness, to publish his theory, because he did not wish to play into the hands of political radicals, nor did he wish to offend his friends in the scientific community. Above all, he was anxious to retain the credibility his Beagle work had won him. So, baldly put, Darwin's reluctance to publish his theory seems pusillanimous. Desmond and Moore show that the pressures were exigent and the paralysing illnesses Darwin suffered as a result of the conflict bear witness to its severity. In the end, Darwin was forced to publish. During the 1850s, the intellectual climate changed, although controversy was still fierce, but the precipitating factor was the announcement by a young naturalist living in Borneo, Alfred Russel Wallace, of a similar theory. Darwin saw that he could no longer wait. The Origin of Species appeared in 1859 and was the subject of attacks by Bishop Samuel Wilberforce and others, but when it became clear that a strong grouping of scientists and liberal thinkers was on his side, Darwin found himself liberated. He participated in the debate, not without anxiety, but not without a certain relish either, publishing defences and extensions of his views, among them his Descent of Man. It is not insignificant that in the last decade of his life he enjoyed markedly improved health and serenity. In essentials, Darwin's theory remains important as one of the founding insights of modern biological science. By any standard, his life's work represents a magnificent contribution. The author's own contribution in putting this epic of the 19th century into so readable a form is itself considerable. Darwin and his world stand out vividly from the page, and so racy is the prose and so fascinating the tale it tells that on reaching the end one is surprised at how much history and science one has learnt. On the way, the author's encyclopedic knowledge never slows the pace, and by the last page one feels that their subject is entirely one's own. This is a rare achievement in biography, and Desmond and Moore deserve high praise for it. That's a review in the Financial Times of a book, Darwin, published by Michael Joseph, price £20.